Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, unfortunately, the Chancellor failed to listen to Simon's pleas and rants. Perhaps you missed our recent podcast. But what was announced in the spring budget? Well, there weren't many rabbits, that's for sure. We knew quite a lot of it beforehand. We had another cut to national insurance, a change to child benefit, a British ISA, and a freeze to alcohol and fuel duty. There was bad news for vapers, first-time buyers and pensioners, and Simon and I. So were you a winner or a loser of the budget? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost-effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, on Wednesday, the Chancellor delivered what is likely to be his last financial statement before the election, but who knows? Was it chock full of tasty tax giveaways to woo the voters? Not so much. We already knew he was going to announce another cut to national insurance, freeze fuel duty, and probably make some changes to ISAs to get us investing in Britain. So did we learn anything new? Before we delve into the details, I will ask you, as I always ask you after these big financial statement events, what did you make of it? Simon, welcome.
Thank you, Georgie. I think too little, too late is my verdict on the budget. I can see what Jeremy Hunt is trying to do with the 2p cut in national insurance, which, let's face it, comes after another 2p cut in national insurance. And that's going to save higher rate taxpayers £1,500 a year, basically that collective 4p cut in national insurance. But at the same time, as Mr. Hunt is standing there saying, I'm cutting your taxes. Look at me. Don't vote for them. We're the party of tax cuts. He's actually putting them up because he continued to freeze the income thresholds, which means more people are dragged into basic rate tax. Many, many more people are being dragged into higher rate tax. More people are being dragged into other tax bands. You know, once people who get put their personal allowance taken away from them, people who go into the 45p tax band, and so on and so on. And I think the problem that Mr. Hunt faces is twofold. One, he doesn't have the money available to him to reverse what has been done to people's incomes by freezing tax thresholds and the big tax squeeze on middle to higher earners over the past 5 years or so. Two, he doesn't have the time to do anything about it either, and he has to look like he is trying to do something about it. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place. And I think that the terrible irony of the situation is that if he had just put all of the tax allowances back to where they were before Boris Johnson was elected, so nearly 5 years ago, so 5 years worth of tax allowances have changed since then. We've had the 2019 tax year to 2020. We're now about to go on to the 2024 to 2025. If he'd have just put those tax thresholds back to where they were before Boris Johnson was elected, it wouldn't really make any difference to people. And I think that says a lot about how we've gone nowhere in those 5 years, because also it's worth bearing in mind that over that five-year period, inflation has been about 22%. So I think too little, too late, unfortunately. And, you know, some of the measures are welcome, but they're not going to be enough because of the damage that's already been done.
Right, well, we'll dig into that. But Lee, when I was sort of watching it on the telly in the studio and I was looking at all the commentary on my phone, multimedia viewing, some commentator said Jeremy Hunt appears to be as unconvinced by his lackluster budget as the rest of us. It was, I mean, lackluster, I think, was a good term to use. I was sort of nodding off halfway through. There wasn't really anything surprising. I didn't feel like there was, I don't know what I was expecting, maybe a bit of long-term kind of views that, yes, we are the party that's going to see us through and ignoring the fact we're going to get pummeled potentially. I don't know what I was expecting, but more than that.
It was a bit meh, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I must admit, Georgie, you know, I was a little bit, I'm a bit the same as you, really. For the first time ever, I found myself sort of clocking off and sort of not really absorbing it all. I felt like everything kind of packed a punch towards the end, but the punch wasn't exactly a Mike Tyson-esque punch. It was more of a kind of gentle slap, I would say. And I have to agree with Simon as well. It feels like it has been 5 years of sort of going nowhere. Now, the big other thing, of course, other than inflation, has been the pandemic as well, which has meant the sort of headroom of cuts and things that could be made, I think has made it very difficult. But I think if you ask the average person on the street, you know, the big idea is that the national insurance, another cut, great, more pounds in your pocket for workers. But then in the other breath, people are saying, but I know that income tax, the thresholds are frozen. So it's all getting a bit confusing, I think, for people. You know, it's good on one hand to see a tax being cut, but on the other hand, as Simon says, the frozen income tax thresholds, I think, are way bigger kind of problem for the Chancellor, and it really is in the public psyche. Now, there was some good in the budget. There was some kind of some stuff that wasn't really all that interesting, if I'm being frank. Most of it was just out there already, which I never really like. I think it should be kind of
Lee, explain to people that aren't in sort of journalism, don't really, was that a great coup by the papers to get that? Was that a deliberate move by the... Why would you give away your big... I mean, I wouldn't call it rabbit out of the hat, but you know what I mean? Why would you... The big takeaway, why would you give it away beforehand?
Well, in the weeks and months coming up to the budget, there's always a lot of kite flying, isn't there, to see what's going to stick and what the public mood is for different things. And that happens every single budget. When we've seen it, for example, it looked like a shoo-in that inheritance tax was going to be cut in the Autumn Statement, for example, and then there was a lot of backlash and that didn't happen. So there's lots of kite flying. Lots of these ideas get out there. They get leaked, you know, big department, lots going on. But I think that going back to your point about it all feeling a bit lackluster, I think because we knew about the 2p cut, it looked almost like it was nailed on. We kind of knew about the British ISA seemed quite nailed on as well. You're kind of thinking, all right, great. So we know that almost as the base, that's the base level of the budget. So that must mean there's going to be a couple of real kind of things out there that are going to really change our lives. But it just didn't happen that way. But as I say, look, it's not all bad. It's not all kind of lackluster. There was some stuff in there. I think, you know, for example, like the British ISA, I'm not a massive fan, as in like another ISA, but at the same time, I've kind of looked through the details and I've softened a little bit towards it and seen that reader reaction is actually pretty strong on it. We'll get into more detail in all of those things.
But
I don't want to. I'm trying to find some chinks of light.
I know. You know, I appreciate that positivity. Honestly, I really do, because afterwards I was just a bit like, even the national insurance, there were too many things, foibles that Simon's raised, that we've raised on the podcast, especially within the tax system, that it would have been lovely to have seen those just rectified. The frozen tax thresholds for me were just such a big one, because it's like you're cutting tax, but you're still sneakily taking it away. Just doesn't sit well with me. But let's go into that. Simon Lambert, National Insurance, to be cut again. So for employees, another 2% cut coming in April. The first was announced in the Autumn Statement. Obviously, there's been loads of national insurance changes recently. What are we, five? Are we six in this government? I don't know, but either way. So the first came in January for the employed. Self-employed had to wait until April. Now they'll get a double whammy of a cut. But with no frozen threshold change, are we actually going to be better off? Simon?
Well, you made me laugh to myself there, because, of course, I've forgotten conveniently in my head about that point when we were like randomly putting national insurance up and then taking it back down and then putting it back up again.
Social levy,
Us personal finance journalists were getting confused as to what the actual rate of national insurance was now. That sort of Grand Old Duke of York national insurance period has now been followed by it being brought down substantially. And then there's this idea floated after the budget of, well, maybe we're just going to get rid of it altogether. I don't actually think that was necessarily Jeremy Hunt's plan at all. I think some people just like came up with an idea and ran with it. And Jeremy Hunt went, I definitely want to do that. I mean, he could promise anything now, really, couldn't he? So it's going to save people money. If you earn £25,000, it's going to save you about £248.60 a year. If you earn £35,000, it's going to save you, I'm going to start rounding numbers now, about £450 a year. If you earn £50,000, it's going to earn you about £750 a year. And once you go into the higher rate tax threshold, the effect stops stepping up and you save £754 a year from this cut. And you're going to double that because remember, we've had another cut in the autumn statement. Okay. So that is putting money into people's wage packets they would not otherwise be getting. And they'll see it on a monthly basis. So on a monthly basis, if you're on 25 grand, you're going to see an extra £21. If you're on 35 grand, you'll see an extra £37. If you're on £50,000, you see an extra £63. And then everybody else is just going to see an extra £63. So that's not bad. I guess if people look at their bills, though, and start adding up how much all of the things that they pay for each month have gone up by over the last year, they might find that the answer is more than £63 at the highest end and almost certainly more than £21 at the lowest end, which gives you a nice little exercise in why you need to raise tax thresholds with inflation. Because if you add up all of those things that you're spending on, you'll realize quite how much the cost of living is going up by, and you'll realize why, therefore, you need to take that same amount out of tax at the lowest end and out of higher rate tax at the highest end, and so on and so on. But, you know, this is effectively an income tax cut. Why isn't it an income tax cut, though? That's the big question, isn't it? And the reason why it isn't an income tax cut is because if you cut income tax, it's more expensive because everybody pays income tax, whereas only people of working age pay national insurance. Now, there has been some serious grumbling from some quarters about how this is very unfair on pensioners and that they haven't had a tax cut. It is worth pointing out that they haven't had this tax cut because they don't actually pay this tax. So they benefit from zero on this tax, whereas even now with the tax cut, other people are paying 8%. Once national insurance goes up into the higher rate, 40% income tax threshold, you only start to pay 2p above that. And that 2p is remaining the same.
So Lee, okay, zero for pensioners, but I think the forecasts are, you know, by the end of this personal tax threshold freeze, the state pension will have risen above that limit. So then all pensioners who are receiving the state pension certainly will be paying income tax.
Yeah, it starts to get a bit... This is what pensioners are kind of collectively grumbling about, Georgie. And this is going to be something I think that's going to be more grumbles as time goes on. Because I think it's something like 60% of pensioners now pay income tax. So, you know, you can see why they'd be grumbling.
Which does that mean, and someone made a point on X about this, a financial advisor, does that mean that 40% are not earning enough to over £12,500 to pay tax? Now, that is a worry. That is a worry. While it's like, wow, 60% are paying tax, 40% don't earn enough to pay tax, it sounds like.
Well, it depends on the way you kind of look at that and digest that information, Georgie, to be quite honest. But
Politician's answer?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it is quite a politician's answer. But I mean, looking here from the IFS, right? So the IFS have crunched some figures on this, the Institute for Fiscal Studies. They're saying that most pensioners will be 650 quid a year worse off by 2027. And higher rate taxpayer pensioners will be more than £3,000 a year worse off. And then you can kind of say, yeah, that's why the people that are having to pay income tax are quite cheesed off. And then you're talking about there where state pension could be heading towards the end of the decade if the major political parties stick with the triple lock pledge and where that could head. Yeah, and then you can see why it's almost like one of those things that's coming over the hill that's going to irk a lot of pensioners. And then you could argue that the Conservatives. I don't really want to get too political because, you know, I just don't want to. But they, you would argue that pensioners are their core voting group. And yeah. then to be kind of not doing anything that they feel is benefiting them is not a good move. And I don't know what the mood music is amongst pensioners and Conservative voting pensioners, but I don't think this was a budget for them. This was more of a budget a little bit for workers in terms of the NI cut and a little bit with the child benefit move as well, more like a family move. But yeah, pensioners are grumbling off the back of this budget, Georgie.
It sort of annoys me a little bit that, sorry, it sort of annoys me the higher rate paying tax pensioners, because you may have sacrificed massively in your younger years to be able to give yourself that like much better quality of life, and then you're just being hammered. Sorry, Simon. I do want to also ask Simon, after you've spoken about it, is if national insurance is going to be abolished, which Jeremy Hunt has sort of intimated, how will we pay for things like state pensions and benefits? I thought that was what it was for.
Well, that's a bit of a misnomer.
Obviously.
Is that the right word?
Yeah, it's a second tax, isn't it?
There isn't really. The state pension is really more of a Ponzi scheme where the people at the bottom are paying in to pay the people at the top at the same time, rather than there being this ring-fenced pot for the state pension. There is a national insurance fund. What's interesting is that if you did abolish national insurance altogether, then you would have to find another way of calculating how many years, qualifying years, people have racked up for their state pension. Because at the moment, that is based on national insurance. There's been talk about merging the taxes for a long time. And I think that there's a good argument for that, because at the end of the day, we're seeing an argument about this kind of like, well, hang on a minute, we're not getting a tax cut because, you know, you're getting a tax cut, but we're not getting one. And then it's like, yeah, but you're not paying this tax anyway. And then it's like, well, I did pay it for X number of years and I got my pension now. So I've paid in and I shouldn't pay this tax. And then you go round and round in circles arguing about the ins and outs of it. The big question is, do you really need two income taxes? Because that's what you've got. You've got income tax and you've got national insurance. And then at the state pension age, you get to stop paying national insurance. There's long been an argument to merge it. It's misleading because you get this talk of our 20% rate of tax. There is no 20% rate of tax. It's 30% because it's 20% plus 10%. I mean, good news is it's soon going to be 28%. Then so it will go 28, 42, 45, what, 47 actually. But it doesn't really go that, does it? Because we all know it actually goes 62 before it goes to 47. And we'll get onto that in a minute. But just to put some numbers on this pension thing and why pensioners are feeling aggrieved. And I think also there's something else that we need to draw on here, which is the vast majority of people, I suspect, making a massive generalization here, right, don't realize that you pay tax on the state pension. I think this comes as a surprise to many people who are not in the know. So I think there's lots and lots of people out there who aren't that financially engaged and even are financially engaged. And one day they suddenly learn that actually you pay tax on the state pension. They go, what, huh? Because it seems a bit crazy. You give people money and then you take some of it back. That doesn't seem the most logical way of doing things. So the question is, why don't you just make the state pension tax-free? Technically, at the moment, if you only have the state pension as your income, the state pension is tax-free, though, because the personal allowance is 12,570, and after the triple lock bump, the state pension is going to be about 11,500. So the projections that we've seen and the argument that's been going on over the last few weeks is if the triple lock keeps going up, the pension keeps going up, the triple lock, and the personal allowance remains frozen, as it's meant to, then at one point, the state pension is going to overtake the personal allowance. And one of the problems with this is that then you're going to have all these pensioners having to fill in self-assessment tax returns in order to declare their extra income, because they might have extra income from savings accounts and things like that. And actually, there's many, many more of them having to do that now because they've got more than the personal allowance plus the personal savings allowance. And it does seem a bit crazy to be making these people to do them. So maybe actually we should just have a conversation about whether just the state pension should just be tax-free completely. And then people only pay tax on that. But then does that mean that you then remove the personal allowance from pensioners? Because otherwise they're getting the state pension tax-free, and then they're getting another £12,570 on top of it. But the reason why they do have a right to feel slightly aggrieved is if you are a pensioner and your income is £12,570 at the moment. So you've got your state pension, and then you've got a small work pension that you had, and then you've got a bit of interest from savings. At the moment, you would pay no tax. Inflation over the past tax year is probably going to average about 6%. It's only 4% at the moment, but it's probably over the course of that year, it's talked that it's going to average about 6%, right? If the personal allowance was uprated by 6%, it would go to £13,325. But it's not being uprated. It's staying exactly where it is. And that means that an extra £754 is being dragged into tax for those people. And if you look at that, at what they will pay in tax over the course of the year at 20%, that means they're going to pay an extra £151 in tax over the course of the year because of the failure to move that personal allowance. So they're then looking at someone who would be earning that same amount of money from income, and so would be paying national insurance, and going, well, they're getting a tax cut, which at least makes up a little bit for that threshold not going up. So why aren't I getting one? But it is a very interesting debate that we could spend an entire podcast talking about. We want to talk about some of the other stuff in the budget, don't we?
We do.
I'll shut up about it now.
No, but I enjoyed that, Simon. I enjoyed it. But we do need to plough on through the many. There weren't actually that many, so that's fine. But we will talk about, Lee, you mentioned it there, the British ISA, which is just what we need. More complexity around ISAs. But it is for a good cause, Lee Boyce. It is for Britain. Yes, the Chancellor announced that for those people who can actually max out their ISAs, there aren't that many, but there's a few, you can get an extra £5,000 a year to invest tax-free if you back UK assets. A politically motivated stunt ahead of upcoming elections or a well-considered strategy aimed at sustainable economic growth in our great country. You decide. Lee.
You made
that. I mean, it's not really. I hammed that up, didn't I? Because it's not really that exciting, is it? It's not like it's a brand new ISA. It's just a bit of. It's like £5,000 extra on those. What is it? 700,000 people that maxed out their stocks and shares ISAs last year.
800,000. But you made me laugh at the start there because you made Britain sound like a charity. The way you were like, it's for a good cause. I was like,
Lee, love. Honestly, have you seen the state of the roads?
Well, maybe we should, a pothole ISA, is that what you is that you're suggesting? A pisser, sorry, a pisser.
nice ring to it.
We so need a pothole filling ISA. So need a pothole filling ISA.
So can I just start by saying it's not a British ISA, it's actually the official name is the UK ISA. Apologies about that. British ISA sounds way better than UK ISA.
ISA or the YUK-ISA.
YUK-ISA, yeah. So what this is essentially, as you say, 800,000, well, as you didn't say, you said 700,000, but 800,000 maxing out stocks and shares ISA. This is going to probably play into their hands because it will be another £5,000 additional. It's like an additional ISA, essentially, which will allow you to put £5,000 into UK assets. Now, there's lots of questions around this, and we don't fully know how this is going to look. There's a consultation on how to design and deliver the ISA, which will run until the 6th of June. But let's face it, the earliest possible date that this ISA could be launched would be the next financial year, which would start April 2025. You might not have the same government then, and this whole idea could just be kicked into a bin. You know, so that could happen. But I understand the logic behind it, but there's a lot of questions around how it would actually work and what actually classes as a UK asset. I mean, you only have to look at the FTSE 100 to see how many,
right
in that index. You know, do they count? What counts? I think there's going to be a lot of arguments about this. It's a kind of move. There was a Mansion House speech recently in which this has been a kind of sort of front and center of what they're looking at in terms of trying to boost investment into UK firms, because what's happened is a lot of default funds and a lot of pension funds are very multinational and lots of heavy weighting on other countries that are not Britain. And it seems like the government's a little bit fed up of that, and they want more money to be pouring into UK businesses to kind of give them a shot in the arm. And we've had lots of talk recently about the Magnificent Seven in the US and how much they're cropping up, you know, our pension funds for one, because a lot of our pensions are in, you know, American companies, for example. So it's how can you give a shot in the arm to UK businesses? There's going to be a lot of talk about how this will actually look and feel. You get the impression, I mean, £5,000 doesn't actually really sound like an awful lot. But if 800,000 people are maxing that £20,000 stocks and shares, you would have thought that they would be quite ripe to think, well, this is another tax break and I'll give it a go. But it needs to be simple. I mean, the thing is, as soon as you say, oh, there's another ISA, I go, oh, do we need another ISA? Is it really what we need? And especially because they're meant to be simple. Well, they are simplifying ISAs from next month. You'll be able to subscribe into more than one type of ISA instead of the kind of having to pick at a fixed rate or an easy access. I mean, some companies do offer flexible ISAs already, but you know, you'll be able to have more movement about what you do with your ISA cash. And then we're now throwing another ISA into the big pot of ISAs. Yeah, I'm not completely sold on it, but the one thing I would say about this, and I reckon Simon might agree, is that our readers have been quite interested in it. As in, there's been a lot of people reading the stories about the British ISA, probably more so than any of the other budget stories. So it suggests that there would be appetite.
It might do, but also I think people are entertained by the fact that this has really divided people. Is it a great thing? Is it not a great thing? It's got a little bit of an argument going. I'm quite enjoying it. Simon, how is it going to work? And is it a good idea?
Well, we don't know exactly how it's going to work because, as Lee said, there's still a consultation out about it. So one of the first questions was, well, what counts as a UK company? And then there's like, I mean, if it's a UK company that does loads of its business overseas, does that count? If it's just a foreign company that's listed on the UK stock market, does that count? It's lucky all those Russian ones collapsed. Then there was the investment trust question. If it's an investment trust, does this count? The investment trust body, the AIC, who are great, I'm going to say, you know, they are great. I love the AIC, was straight out of the traps with a, we think all investment trusts should qualify statement, which would be great. I'm very pro that. It would sort of be flying in the face of the idea behind it in terms of supporting British businesses if you could stick Scottish Mortgage in your British ISA, because it doesn't really invest that much in the UK. But then actually, when you think about it, what are they trying to do here? Are they trying to get money going into the shares of UK companies, or are they just trying to boost the UK stock market? And if they're trying to boost the UK stock market and make it a more attractive place for companies to list, and also a more attractive place for companies not to delist from, which is the big issue, is companies skipping over to the US instead. It doesn't really matter whether you allow investment trusts in or not, and whether they're actually invested in the UK. You want everything in. You were just like, hey, come on, everybody in, join the party. Come to London, list here. This is a good idea. I think the trick that Jeremy Hunt missed here is that he should have also added the removal of stamp duty on shares, which is 0.5% of share purchases. It's an outdated, daft tax, one that should be put in the stupid bin for those who listened to the podcast 2 weeks ago. And we should have got rid of that as well. And that would have given this the extra little bit of a boost that it could have had. As Lee said, many people think this is a slightly daft idea. The UK stock market currently makes up about 4% of the global market. The British ISA will make up 20% of an annual ISA allowance of £25,000. So you are massively overweighting your own country, which is something that investors are regularly told not to do. But now the government is going to sponsor them to do it. So there are some questions raised over the wisdom of this. But hey, look, if someone offers you an extra £5,000 worth of ISA allowance, you know, say thanks and don't take it as a kick in the face. And at the end of the day, the really important thing to remember is you need to get as much of your investments into ISAs as possible, because that nice Mr. Hunt, who's apparently on the side of investors, has absolutely slashed two of the key allowances that investors rely on, the capital gains tax allowance and the dividend allowance. There's a report out a few weeks ago saying that capital gains, hardly anybody actually pays capital gains tax. It's massively skewed towards one end of the country, and so we shouldn't worry about it. But that's when the allowance was £12,300 a year. The Chancellor, in his wisdom, has taken that allowance down from £12,300 a year to £3,000 from April. That is a massive attack on small investors. And I'll tell you why it's a massive attack on small investors. Because the really, really rich people who pay themselves in shares and cash in the capital gains so they don't pay income tax rates and things like that, they don't care about the £12,300 a year allowance. That's peanuts to them. These are people making hundreds of thousands of pounds or millions of pounds a year. A £12,300 capital gains tax allowance means zip. If you're a small investor who's built up a portfolio of shares over the years, perhaps when ISA allowances were much less generous, or you got shares from work through the various share schemes that you could have where you save into them and then you held on to them over the years and you've built up a nice little nest egg of shares, you're going to get really, really hit by this because you're going to face having much, much more of your profits taxed than you would have done. And that £9,000 that's going to be taxed is going to make a much bigger difference to you than the stinking rich. Okay. Dividends. The dividend allowance is being cut down to £500. It was £2,000 not that long ago before Jeremy Hunt started attacking it. And it was only £2,000 because it had already been attacked. And the dividend allowance was only introduced because dividend rates were raised to stop stinking rich people paying themselves in dividends so as to avoid income tax. And the collateral damage of that was small investors, but at least they got the dividend allowance. That's gone from 5,000 to 2,000 to 1,000, and it's now going to £500. The attack that has been made on small investors in this country, and actually, this is an attack on pensioners because you're more likely to be relying on investments outside of an ISA if you are older and a pensioner and built them up in years when ISA allowances were much, much lower than they are now. The attack on small investors by this government has been absolutely disgraceful. Those are, again, allowances that should have been going up with inflation, and instead they've absolutely cratered. And I think that they should be ashamed of themselves for what they've done there.
I'm sorry, Simon. I love that sort of school mister kind of, they should be ashamed of themselves. And not to be a political podcast, but I sort of, following on from what he said, I would have suggested a lot of those would have been Conservative voters.
And the other thing is, the reason why Jeremy Hunt should have reversed those capital gains and dividend attacks in this budget is because I think that, you know, there's not many people, probably including Jeremy Hunt, who think that there's much chance that the Conservatives are going to win the next election and he's still going to be Chancellor. So it's very, very likely things could change. Who knows what's going to happen? It's very, very likely that they're going to be handing the baton to a Labour government. And a Labour government is not going to put that capital gains tax allowance back up, and it's not going to put that dividend tax allowance back up. So unfortunately, nope. There's a very strong possibility that we have now been permanently lumbered with that until many, many years into the future. And that will directly affect the finances of people who have less money, not the stinking rich who couldn't really care less.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our Investing Explained segment. Dan, welcome to the podcast in Budget Week. A new British ISA was announced in the budget, and it's definitely caught investors' imaginations. What is it, and what's the idea behind it?
So the British ISA is a new government initiative that was announced this week in the 2024 budget. It is a new type of ISA. It has an additional £5,000 annual allowance. So that will sit on top of the current ISA limits, and it'll allow people to invest up to £25,000 each tax year. So whilst the government is still ironing out the exact details of how this will work, what we know at this stage is that the £5,000 will need to be invested in UK companies. So the idea is to encourage people to invest into British companies and therefore boost the UK stock market. The incentive really by the government is simply to extend the same tax benefits that you get in a normal stocks and shares ISA.
So will this help investors, do you think?
I think any tax-efficient products are always welcome, and therefore there'll be demand from certain types of investors. So the ISA contribution limit has been stuck at £20,000 since 2017, and therefore an increase to this limit has been a long time coming. However, there's only a relatively small amount of people maximise their ISA contributions each year, so this increased allowance will help them, but it won't really help the majority of people. How effective that additional £5,000 will be to the UK stock market is to be seen. We don't actually know what types of investment will count as a UK company, so the devil will be in the details, really. We'll have to wait to find out more.
Well, we'll all be keenly waiting to find out those exact details. Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Before we get into the other, I suppose the bigger surprise of the budget was the child benefit. Before we do that, there was a lot of things that were not in there that I think people would have been hoping for. I'm not talking about the £100,000 quirk to the tax system. Simon will have his moment on that shortly, Lee. But I sort of noted, I mean, nothing on inheritance tax. That wasn't really a surprise, even though that seems to be mooted for ages. First time buyers, there wasn't really anything in that. There was, however, some movements to try and discourage people from listing their home on Airbnb, it seems. So to get the rental market moving. Yeah. Disappointing for a lot of people, I would have suggested. Lily, what did you make of perhaps the housing moves in there?
Yeah, I could talk through some of the property stuff, but basically that wasn't in there, Georgie, to be quite frank with you, as you were saying. So, for example, there was quite a lot of talk about stamp duty and reforming stamp duty, perhaps getting rid of it altogether, but absolutely nothing was mentioned on stamp duty. We've got a situation in which between above £250,000, you get a stamp duty bill, right? So between £250 and £675, it's 5%, right? That's what affects most, the majority of people. That's going to go down to £125 next year. And there was no mention of that changing. So that looks like it is going to be happening now. So more people are going to be facing more stamp duty bill. We went and crunched the figures from the OBR. And by the financial year 2028-2029, it will be £22.1 billion, the annual stamp duty bill. This year, it's estimated it will be £12.7 billion. That's a massive jump in the stamp duty bill that people are paying simply to move home. Is that fair? I'm not sure. In terms of first-time buyers, there was hardly anything. There's nothing really even to properly mention, George, to be honest. I mean, talking about, you know, this 99% mortgage.
I thought we were going to get that, what they decided to scrap that.
Well, they realise it's a daft idea, I think, George. Well, it is a daft idea, you know, but, you know, the lifetime ISA stuff, you're talking about the amount of money that you can buy a home, that the price of a home is going to be £450,000. There was talks of that potentially going a bit higher just because of house price inflation from the last couple of years, but that didn't happen.
Lee, I've got to jump in at this moment because Simon's going to have his rant, but I have recently just had to release my lifetime ISA, having diligently started to save for it in my 30s when I was a wee young thing, when this was first introduced in 2017, and the limit was £450,000, which at the time, living in London, okay, it was a stretch, but it's absolutely fine. I am now on the other side of 30. It's called in my 40s. Looking to buy my first home and therefore have other responsibilities, you know, partners with kids and those sorts, as people do when they grow older and need more from their homes. Alas, the 450,000 limit has not been extended as one would hope. I think it's sort of, we'd be reaching about 600,000 if it had gone up with house price inflation. But I would have thought, as I am using it to buy a house, that I should not be penalised. Fair enough, take back the penalty, take back the bonus. That's absolutely fine. But my £5,000 investment gains should be mine, should they not? No, they're not. So what would have been a 32,000 or whatever lovely part of my deposit has now whittled down to 23, I think. Thank you very much, Jeremy Hunt. How difficult would it have been just to say, if you are using this to buy a house, but it is over the limit, you will just have the bonus taken away, but you can have the rest. Really not happy with that.
That's where a lot of the argument would be. And that, unfortunately, that's where the lifetime ISA kind of coming home to roost type thing, Georgie. You know, that it was warned on the tin when you opened it, but when you get further down the line and these things actually start to rack up, and then you see how much is going to be taken
seven
away.
7 years later.
Yeah, and that's the problem.
No change. Seven years later.
It's a product that is a very confusing product. You know, saving for a home and saving for retirement, two very different things, crazy, as we've mentioned before. So I feel your pain, Georgie. I really do. And there were talks about it, there being some changes to it, but absolutely nothing happened there. There was some buy to let news. So landlords planning to sell have been handed a tax cut. So the capital gains charged on the sale of second homes will go down from 28% to 24% for higher rate taxpayers. I'm guessing to try and get the market moving a little bit more, you know, and encouraging landlords potentially to sell up if they want to. And I'll try and end on some good news for you, Georgie, shall I? So the OBR...
Will it give me a few £1,000s back, Lee?
Well, actually, probably quite possibly might do. Because the OBR forecasting... Well, first of all, OBR forecast in November, the Autumn Statement, that house prices would fall 5% this year. They're now reversing that back and saying that the house prices are going to fall 2%. But that's not the good news. That's just house prices.
I've just bought, Lee.
Sorry, that's not helping you. And actually, this, if you've already bought and you've got your mortgage in place, then perhaps this isn't going to help.
But they've
massively rode back on the forecast of where mortgage rates are going to peak. So they're now saying they're going to peak at 4.2% now, instead of 5% by 2027. So the line on this graph, this is when we need a visual on the podcast, it's quite a big gap between what was forecast in the Autumn Statement and what's been forecast in the most latest OBR sort of report. And actually, that could make quite a big difference. You know, you're talking almost a percentage point lower mortgage rates. It's a kind of taking of a stock of all mortgages. So people have still got, some people have still got really low rate, fixed rates. You know, so that skews it a bit. But it looks like it's going to be a softer kind of mortgage rate rises over the coming 4 or 5 years.
Lovely. Great. All right, Simon, there are two other sort of big quirks in the tax system that we were, or the system, as it were, that we have highlighted, and many personal finance journalists have highlighted, you particularly on one area, which we'll get into in a minute. But the other one was the child benefit, the system that really does penalise one parent households or one breadwinner households. That's going to be changed. So explain how that's going to change.
The child benefit removal has been a problem ever since it was introduced. In fact, it was a problem before George Osborne managed to even introduce it, when he had to revise his own policy before he brought it in. What this does is it takes child benefit away from parents at a certain point when the highest earner's income breaches a certain level. And since it was introduced, that level has been £50,000. Child benefit is removed between £50,000 and £60,000. And what this does is creates sky-high marginal tax rates for parents who are affected. So rather than paying 40% income tax, they're paying nearly, with one child, they're paying nearly 50%. With two children, they're paying more, and so on and so on. And it's created one of the elements of one of the world's craziest tax system charts, which is the UK tax system. We'll talk about this a bit more in a minute with the removal of the personal allowance. Whereby what you want to see with the tax system is that tax rates go up progressively as people's income rises. Instead, with the UK tax system, tax rates go up, and then there's what's been described as a tower of doom for parents, where you get some bits stacked up depending on how many children they have, one child, two child, three children. Then it goes down again and stays at 42%. Then it goes up to 62% when people get their personal allowance removed. Then it goes back down to 47% once people's personal allowance has gone. And the problem with this is that it means that people are paying more money in tax on the next pound they earn, their marginal tax rate, than people who are earning much more than them. And to put that in context, it basically means that if you are affected by one of these things and you get a pay rise, you are going to see proportionally less of your pay rise than somebody who earns £200,000 a year will see of theirs. I mean, it is true that the person earning £200,000 a year will have gone through all of those tax quirks on the way to their £200,000, but it does not seem to be the best way to run a tax system. And the chart that I was talking about has been doing the rounds round and round about in various forms. We've got our own one. It's color-coded. It's an absolute thing of beauty. We've been sticking it all over the place. We even tweeted it to Jeremy Hunt this week in the build-up to the budget and said, "Dear Mr. Hunt, maybe perhaps you could have a look at this while you're doing the finishing touches." Well, Jeremy Hunt has done something to sort of help with the child benefit problem, and he's doing it in two stages. The second stage tackles one of the big problems with it, which is that it's assessed only on one parent's income. So you could have two parents in a household who earn £49,000 a year and they get to keep all their child benefit, right? Which is worth quite a lot of money to people. You've got two kids, it's worth about two grand a year. But if one of them earns more than £50,000, they start losing it. And if just one of them earns more than £60,000, they get nothing. So this is a very unfair situation on single earner households, households where one earner is a higher earner and one earner is a lower earner and things like that. So Mr. Hunt said, this isn't right. We shouldn't be doing this. Conveniently ignoring the government that brought this in. This isn't right. We shouldn't be doing this. Conveniently ignoring the fact that they've been doing this for 11 years. This isn't right. We shouldn't be doing this. So we're going to assess it on household income. But that's actually quite complicated and not the way how it works. So that's not coming in for a while. But he has delivered an immediate benefit to people, which is he has looked at it and he has gone, these high marginal tax rates are not right. So I am going to shove this further up the scale. I'm going to take this tax trap and I'm just going to kick it down the road. So rather than having child benefit removed from £50,000 to £60,000, it's now going to be removed from £60,000 to £80,000, which is great news for anybody who was in the 50 to 60 band before. Anybody who's over 60 is going to start losing it. And the effect of moving that, but then also broadening the bracket in which it is taken away from people, doesn't just shove that hump along, it also squishes it down. So he sort of pushed it along and then he's jumped on it and then he's sat on it. So previously, the marginal tax rates, if you had one kid, was 55%, two kids, 64%, three kids, 73%. Those marginal tax rates now are 49% for one child, 53% for two children, 58% for three children. Not great. And he could have actually made this better by making that bracket even bigger. So he could have, for example, gone, it's going to start at 60 and it's going to end at 100. And then that would have smoothed things out a lot more. But that costs more money. And in fact, actually, probably what he should have done is he should have just scrapped it altogether. Now, that's quite controversial, because why should we be giving people who are effectively high earners money just because they have children? I mean, you know, that is problematic, right? And that was what George Osborne said originally. But until George Osborne did this, child benefit was a universal benefit. And there's a lot to be said for universal benefits, because it creates a sort of a general mood within the tax system where people tend to be more supportive of benefits. You don't end up with these problems to do with taperings. Tapering stuff away always creates a problem, always creates these high marginal rates. And maybe it would just be better to go back to that. And ultimately, you'd be putting money in people's pockets that they're probably going to maybe end up spending anyway. So, you know, it might even be, you know, economically beneficial. But I think the real problem with this child benefit thing, to go back to my too little too late comment, is when you think about this, and that it was quite a bad policy in the first place, it was brought in to remove child benefit from people and created these high marginal tax rates, this Tower of Doom, 11 years ago. And that £50,000 threshold hasn't moved for 11 years. Imagine bringing in something into the tax system that, you know, is quite so penal on those affected, and you don't raise the threshold for 11 years. And to go back to my point about the, you know, the personal allowance and the other thresholds, imagine not moving those for 5 years. We're going to be 5 years in and they've barely budged. If you look at this child benefit threshold, if it had gone up with inflation, which is just the most basic thing that it should have gone up with since it was introduced in 2013, it would now be £67,000. So it should be higher even than where Jeremy Hunt is raising it to from April. This is good news, but it's not as good news as it could be, which then takes us back to the personal allowance removal above £100,000. And this takes us back to a problem in our tax system, which we've talked about before. It's like ever since the financial crisis, politicians, chancellors have been absolutely terrified of doing anything that might be seen to benefit people that can be painted as rich, okay? Because they're going to get attacked for it. So that's why they haven't done anything about this £50,000 threshold. And that's why they haven't done anything about the personal allowance removal. The removal of the personal allowance creates a 60% tax rate, income tax rate, above £100,000, between £100,000 and the point where the personal allowance runs out, which is currently £125,000, at which point the income tax rate goes back down to 45p. That is completely nuts. No chancellor, I believe, over the last how many years, honestly, speaking honestly, where they weren't going to be reported, would not tell you that that is completely nuts. And if they had their way, they wouldn't have it. And it's no way to run a tax system. Yet they've all sat on it. But they've not only sat on it, they've allowed that £100,000 to stay exactly the same. And if that £100,000 had gone up with inflation since it was introduced, it would now be £150,000. And the difference between a £100,000 earner and a £150,000 earner is really quite big. Mm. That's a big difference between the type of person you're catching with something and also the amount of people you're catching with it. And that is my real problem with this, and why I've been banging the drum about this thing for so long, is I think tax needs to be fair, and it needs to engender a feeling of fairness in the people who are paying it, particularly as they go up the income scale and start paying more and more tax. You want them to go, I'm paying my fair share and I'm being treated fairly. And I think it's a real problem that we have had these tax quirks in our system for so long, because I think we've lost that. And I think that the wealth creators in this country are creating wealth despite the government, not because of the government. And I think they're paying tax because they have to, and they're all quite grumbly about it, and they'll do anything they can to avoid it. And then you get to that whole thing of like, well, just pay some more into your pension.
As if
people are just sitting there on unlimited amounts of money that they can just whack into a pension. And also, just a policy of just pay more into your pension in order to avoid a crazy tax rate is not a way to run a tax system.
Quite. But I sense, and I think you've used this argument before, that given the current political trajectory, that will not be rectified anytime soon.
I don't know. You know what? Okay, I suspect we've got one more. Maybe you're going to ask us about this in a minute. You're going to ask us about whether we think we've got one more before the election. I think maybe we've got one more before an election. Maybe he's going to sort it out then. But I tell you what, if I was Rachel Reeves, right, I would come out now and say, I've seen that chart. I know what's going on here. I'm going to fix that. And I think she'd win a lot of plaudits from, you know, a lot of different places. Because as I said, when we've talked about this endlessly, apologies to listeners who've had to listen to this repeatedly, the mood has changed on this one. It used to be, oh, Sodom, they're rich. But the mood now in the kind of general vibe around it, the conversations you see, the comments you read, you know, the stuff on Twitter and so on, is people saying this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. And I actually think that whether the Chancellor stood up and did it, whether the Shadow Chancellor stood up and did it, or whether the Lib Dems suggested it, or maybe even Reform UK want to stick it in their policies, or any of the other, you know, I'm not sure we'll see the SNP do it, because their tax rates are even crazier. Apologies to all listeners north of the border who are listening to this going, why aren't you talking about us? It's even crazier up here. But I think whoever did it would probably win quite a lot of plaudits.
All right, well, those are some of the policies. Let's zoom out. Let's look at the bigger picture. Lee, you spoke there about the OBR talking about house prices and that. They published its latest forecast for the UK economy, inflation, house prices, tax receipts, disposable income, unemployment. What does it all tell us? Are we doomed? The IFS thinks that maybe we could be. So, Lee, are we doomed?
Oh, Georgie, I don't know. Are we doomed? I think it's a bit too much. So yeah, the OBR, publish a lot of the forward forecasts. How accurate they are and how much you want to argue how good they are is open to interpretation. There's a lot of fan charts. There's a lot of kind of like, it could be here and it could be there. So essentially, there's a few in here, and I think a few that we kind of want to know about is inflation. To be honest, the forecast from November 2023 to now isn't all of that different to what we're saying. So OBR saying central forecast see quarterly inflation falling to the 2% target in the second quarter of 2024, a year sooner than we expected in November. We expect inflation to be 2.2% over 2024, then 1.5% in 2025, before rising to the target of 2% in 2028. Proof will be in the pudding. Let's see. Yeah, and also interest rates, of course. We've had loads of different kind of sort of predictions for this year. The forecast is actually fairly different to what they were forecasting in November. Currently it's at 5.25%. OBR saying in the medium term, bank rate falls to 3.3%, almost 0.75 percentage point lower than November's forecast. But expectations remain volatile, aka don't take this as gospel, is the way I see that. We've already talked about house prices and mortgage rates. And then you look at everything else. You look at average earnings, you look at unemployment, you look at household income. And whenever I look at these charts, and borrowing as well, government borrowing and debt, you look at these charts and you just see how much it spiked during the pandemic, and just how much we're still trying to claw back to where we was before it all unfolded. And let's face it, it was 4 years ago this month that the whole thing went and hit the fan. And it's quite really stark when you go and drill down. Anyone go and look at this, by the way, you can go on the OBR website and download this report and have a look at the forecast. It really shows you just how difficult that period and how much catching up we are still doing, even with revised OBR forecasts from the moves that were made in this budget compared to the autumn statement. It's quite stark. It's quite interesting. So definitely go and have a look. But I think interest rates and the base rate, base rate and inflation is the one that people will care about the most.
All right, Lee, finally, there is another piece of news of finance related out there that's not budget related. So we're grabbing hold of that with excitement. Or are we? Nationwide Building Society agreeing to buy Virgin Money in a potential $2.9 billion deal. Lots of hoops to jump through first. What will it mean for savers? What will it mean for those with mortgages? Simon Lamber, what do you make of this?
What a bombshell to drop the morning after the budget is what I make of this. Honestly, sit down at your computer, start work, 7 o'clock in the morning after the budget. It's an early start after the budget. And you're like, right, okay, what have we got from yesterday? What have we got from today? What have we got? Oh my word. Nationwide are going to take over Virgin Money. Yeah, there you go. Means actually that Nationwide will basically own part of Northern Rock, because Northern Rock ended up being part of Virgin. And then there was a sort of Clydesdale Bank takeover thing. And then there was, changed its name to Virgin Money again. There is a little bit of it somewhere that's Northern Rock. I've got a savings account. So I think I've got an ISA somewhere.
There you go.
I think it's really interesting, because I think actually one of the things that Nationwide members have been critical of Nationwide about is actually potentially about how big Nationwide is, and that Nationwide is, you know, they're saying, well, it's just a bank in other terms. And that's why Nationwide has done some things recently in order to try and say, no, that's not the case. Actually, you know what? We're on, what's the advert? We're on your side, is it? You know, and we're not a bank. We're different to a bank. And yes, we might make big profits, but the profits go back into providing better deals for our members. The members go, though, they're not good enough, those deals. And then Nationwide says, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to give you a fairer share payment. We're going to give you a surprise payment to say thanks for being a member. Not everybody got those, but you know, that was a really good thing to do. And so now it's going to take on Virgin. It's going to be even bigger. It's going to be the second biggest in, you know, savings and lending operation, you know, in the UK, behind the giant that is Lloyds Banking Group. And I think it's very interesting. And I guess if you are going to have some mega banking entities, then it's a good thing that one of those mega banking entities is a building society that is, you know, responsible to its members, that's owned by its members, in fact, and tries to give some of those profits back to its members.
What does that actually mean,
Simon? Then it's just another bank.
What does that actually mean that it's owned by its members? It's a mutual. It reinvests into. So it what does it make a profit? Like what?
Oh, it does make a
For
profit. It makes
external shareholders. Like how does that even work anymore for those
makes
who
a nice
don't know?
make it makes a nice big profit, but the idea is that those profits go back into the business to provide better deals on mortgages and savings accounts for its members. And so if you have a mortgage or a savings account, you are a Nationwide member. I don't know if you just have a current account with the account as a member. I can't remember. So I'm not gonna, clarify that exactly. But yeah, it's a mutual. It means it's mutually owned. All the members own it. And that's why when building societies in the past demutualized and became banks, that people got payouts. So that's the principle behind the kind of mutual thing. And I think mutual organizations are great. I think building societies are great. I think they're a really good part of the UK financial system. For all the complaints about, they're making, so much money, not all of it's going back into giving me better savings rates. And then the building societies say, well, we can't just like suddenly whack our savings rates up because then everybody come flooding in and it costs you more money and so on. And the arguments about executive pay and all those other things. It's like, but then if you are running something of the size of Nationwide, the argument is that you need to be paid, in a way that you would be paid if you jump ship to running something that was the same size and it's a bank. So there's all kinds of things that you can get into there. But I think overall, building societies equal good thing. And, as I said, if you're going to have like these mega organizations, good that one of them's a building society and not just a bank.
I've been reading through your article about this, and you've been speaking to experts, James Blow, a savings expert, as well as David Hollingworth as well, mortgage expert. Both suggest, Lee, that this move, because I think people will be wondering, oh, goodness me, what does that mean for my savings? What does that mean for my mortgage? Not a lot to worry about. I mean, obviously, this has to go through, has to be accepted by Virgin shareholders, etc., hoops to go through first. But then I think in the short term, nothing will immediately will change. I think Nationwide have suggested this may take up to 6 years to kind of gradually make a change. So, 2 to 5 year mortgage products won't really be affected. Where will this affect us, do you think? How will this play out?
First of all, I think this is a really interesting move. I mean, Nationwide are in effect just a bank. I mean, I say that. I mean, a bank is run for shareholders, and they and building society is meant to be run for members. But I mean, the size of this would just make it absolutely huge. I mean, Virgin has 6.6 million customers. I mean, that's quite sizable. I was actually quite surprised that it was that big. I must confess. So in terms of, and I should also point out here that James, savings guru, said that this offer is at 38% premium on the share price. So Nationwide are obviously gone quite hard off after these customers and to boost the numbers. And as Simon says, sometimes the argument is that it is too big already, and members have seen it grow. And you look at the other building societies that are out there. I mean, Nationwide make them look like absolute minnows. That your Yorkshire Building Society, Coventry Building Society, all pretty big building societies, but nowhere near the size of Nationwide. And actually, one of the only pieces of financial advice my dad ever gave me, my dad never gave me any financial advice because he just isn't very like that. But he was adamant that I opened a Nationwide current account and just had a small savings pot to always just have there, even just with a few quid in case it ever demutualized, so I could get some sort of payout. He was obsessed by this idea that that's what would happen, because Halifax, for example, and a few others like that, it happened in the past, and he was obsessed with this idea that this was going to happen. But would it do that now? I can't see it the way it's kind of evolved. And you're right. And in terms of mortgages, I mean, it will just be a real slow process of if I would compare it to, if you think about like when an energy giant takes over another energy firm and you've got to onboard them and put them into their IT systems and this, that, and the other, it's like that, but it's not an urgent matter. Whereas when you're rescuing energy customers, they've got to come over quite quickly, and quite often that onboarding process goes a bit haywire. I think in here it just sounds like Nationwide will take their time, and if you're a Virgin Money customer at the moment, you will slowly transition into becoming a Nationwide customer over time. But I would get the impression Nationwide wouldn't want to leave it that long, because they're going to want to hoover up as many of these customers as possible, hence why they're paying a premium and going for it. So it's a very, very, very interesting move. And Nationwide have done lots of good things. I've got a bit of a soft spot for Nationwide, to be frank. You know, they continue to be the last branch in town for a lot of places. And whether you believe that this should the rate of bank branch closures is correct or not, at least they're flying the flag for certain towns that have lost all but Nationwide branches, including access to cash machines. Yeah, the payout last year, I think, was a very good thing to do. Yes, they're always going to be in the spotlight for not offering savings rates at the very top. Mortgage rates always, in my opinion, are very competitive. So I think that is it a bad thing for competition, you could argue, because it'll be another provider out, you know, in terms of offering mortgages and offering savings. I don't think it will make a huge effect because I don't see Virgin at the top of those best buys all that often. More so mortgage rates.
Well, they're on the top. Virgin aren't top at the moment for their fixed ISA. I think in terms of savings, it might, because let's be honest, big banks don't tend to offer the greatest savings rates. But there is suggestion that mortgage rates may be more competitive with this move.
Yeah, well, that will, again, I mean, that's...
We'll see. It's many years.
Yeah, well, in between now and 2030, there might be quite a few more competitors launched. Yeah. There might be quite a few more upstarts. There's quite a lot...
Some that have fallen by the wayside.
In the landscape between... I'll be honest, Virgin Money are one of those brands that, in the whole world of savings and banking, are probably one of the bigger names that I'm least familiar about. But the one thing that they did do quite bizarrely a few years ago is open an absolutely giant branch. They spent millions on it in Kensington High Street, which was close to the offices. And I walked past those at least once a week, and I think I probably saw about half a dozen people over those couple of years in there. It was absolutely mammoth. No one was ever in it. I could never understand what the logic was behind it. It's since shut. It shut a little while back. Didn't get it at all. So listen, it's a way for Nationwide to grow its members and the number of people it has. Is it going to be a good move? We don't know, but it's an interesting move nonetheless, and we'll keep an eye on the developments and what goes on. And it, as you say, it's got to get approval. Yeah, I'd be surprised Indeed. If it doesn't, but it will need approval.
All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into. Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments where you can tell us what you thought of the budget, whether it was any good.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.